B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who knows the door code to every on-course restroom in the Southeast, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. And this week, the PGA Tour finally feels like its season is beginning, even though I guess technically we're more than a third of the way through. And it's for this reason. Tiger Woods, for the first time in 2020, for the first time since his triumphant President's Cup captaincy, the undisputed needle mover in the game returns to the site of so many triumphs in his career, Torrey Pines in San Diego. And look, with all apologies to all who have participated and won already this year, it just seems different. It just seems like this week things are starting to count for real. And I know that's incorrect, but I can't help feeling that way. We'll check in at Torrey Pines with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. And also today, we'll chat with Oliver Horovitz, the one-time American caddy at St. Andrews and host of the show Caddy Codes, has written an insane article for golfdigest.com to describe an insane golf tournament literally contested at the top of the world. But first up, from San Diego, Ron Green Jr. Ron, is it because Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy are in the field this week? Because I just get the feeling that the whole golf world is saying, okay, now the golf season has begun, even though I guess technically we're more than a third of the way through it.
Yeah, it feels, in a sense, like the New Year's finally officially kicked off. I mean, Hawaii was great. I know at Palm Springs, you know, they had their moment. But, yeah, this feels bigger. I mean, you got Ricky and Rahm and Tiger and Rory and Spieth and just, you know, so many good players. And, you know, we're also sort of familiar with Torrey Pines and what's happened here and what could happen. And, yeah, I mean, it feels like what we've been waiting for now. It's sort of like there's a momentum now. We already know, okay, we know what Phoenix will be with Super Bowl weekend and all that. Then suddenly it's off to Pebble in L.A., and it feels like, you know, we're off and running now.
I saw something that was very interesting, and as we're recording this is Thursday, in the early round coverage, they flashed up a couple of statistics.
Easy for you to say.
I know it. And it really took me aback. Cam Smith, who won a couple of weeks ago in Honolulu, finished 77th on the PGA Tour last year in driving distance, averaging 301 yards off the tee. His average puts him dead in the middle of the pack. I know that distance report is due to come out sometime next month. That's been done. That's going to be delivered to the USGA and the RNA and the PGA Tour and all that. But that blew me away. I remember when 298 would have led the PGA Tour by a mile, and it doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
Well, Tiger was talking the other day. He said when he came out on tour, he was one of two guys who averaged 300 off the tee. And now, you know, I think he averaged 296.8 last year, which would have put him right about, you know, in the 70s there in terms of driving distance. Now, granted, there are times they hit three wood and all that. But, yeah, I mean, the game has changed entirely. And I believe February 3rd is the day we get the distance report. It'll be interesting to see two things. One, what it reveals, and what, if anything, it sparks or initiates in terms of action or reaction to what they tell us. I mean, we all know how far the ball goes now. And, you know, we've gone from just fixing, you know, fitting club heads and shafts, and now listening to all these players talking about getting all this 3D imaging they're using, you know, the plates on their feet to tell, you know, where their weight goes and all this stuff. I mean, it's become so technologically advanced from the equipment standpoint, from the training, from the preparation standpoint, that it's no wonder it's gotten to where it is. Now, can you put it back in the bottle? I don't know. I mean, I think we don't need it to get any more than it is, and I think a lot of us would like to see it pulled back a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you hear players say all the time, if you can't fly it 300, you're sort of swimming against the tide out here.
Is there a feeling that perhaps the interpretation of the data might be somewhat eye-rolling? And I use this as context. A week or so ago, you and I were talking about the state of pace of play. And you said that Monahan got in front of everybody and said, hey, look, you know, pace of play is still for whatever round, you know, 354 or whatever. And I kind of rolled my eyes at that because I was thinking, okay, how many of the rounds where you've got somebody going out with a marker on Sunday are being taken into effect? Those guys who are speeding around the golf course to catch a plane at the beginning, because my eyeball test tells me that, no, the game has really slowed down on tour. I thought that was just a really eye-rolling interpretation of data, and I'm wondering if there's a feeling that this data could be interpreted that way as well, where it's sort of like here no evil, see no evil, and, you know, and nothing's going to be done.
Well, my expectation is it's going to just reaffirm what we believe and what we've seen. I mean, you and I know the age of when, if you hit a 7-iron 155 yards, that you're getting after it.
Yes.
You know, now they're hitting pitching wedges 155 yards. I mean, they've changed the nature of the game in that regard, and that they hit the ball so far with not just their drivers, but with every club. That the notion of 4 and 5 irons into par fours back when Nelson and Snead and Hogan and them were hitting them, I mean, it is a rare day. Now, granted, here at the South Course at Torrey Pines, they're going to get a few chances with that to hit those shots here because this, you know, they just jump right into the fire out here. But I think we all feel and sense, you know, how much the game has changed. But again, I don't know what's going to happen, how they're going to react to it. I mean, I go back to Fred Ridley last year when asked about potentially moving the 13th tee back at Augusta. And he said, we're going to wait and see what the distance report tells us and what the USGA and the RNA, how they feel about it. So I think the next, you know, I think it's maybe next week or so when that comes out. And then, you know, the days and weeks following it, as people sort of react and digest it all, it's going to be a very interesting time for the game.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is out in San Diego for the who's the spot? Is this still the State Farm or Farmers Insurance?
Farmers Insurance.
Farmers Insurance, and, you know, the Torrey Pines Tournament. He's our guest, taking dead aim. Tiger's press conference the other day. There's lots of interesting things now when you see a Tiger press conference. So they're not near as cliched as they were in his prime. There's a train of thought that this golf course, despite the success that he's had over all these years, that this is a golf course similar to the way Bethpage Black proved to be last May, that this may be too big a ballpark for Tiger Woods. Did he let on anything that might have revealed he would feel the same way?
Not in so many words, but what I think those of us who are in there came away from it with the feeling like he was tamping down some of the almost runaway expectations we already have for this year. You know, you got people on television saying, oh, he's going to win Torrey Pines, he's going to win 3 or 4 times, he's going to knock down another major or two. It's sort of like, you know, it's 2000 again, and it's not. And I think he is, he sort of gave us a little bit of that. You know, he said the sort of analogy he used, the example he used was when he's talking about the Masters, where he says every year you see somebody like Freddie or Bernhardt or somebody play 2 or 3 good rounds, but they can't take it to 4 rounds because it just gets harder when you get older. And he's 44 now. I was ran into Davis Love, now sort of a member of the media doing his new television work, and we were talking about, he goes, it's so different. He said, particularly out here where the air's heavy, he said, you can still hit it out there pretty well, but any misses here feel like they're magnified. And he says it's cold. He goes, and you're in your 40s, you're trying to hit these long shots. He goes, you really feel the difference here. And I think Tiger was smart to just sort of like, okay, we're going to get there. We'll work into it. But don't expect, you know, he, after the President's Cup, he said when he played one little round on his birthday with his son, and then until January 3rd or 4th, didn't even hit a ball. So just sort of ramping it back up. I, like a lot of people, if he stays healthy, I think he's going to have a really, really big year. But I don't know that it's fair to expect him to just walk out here what he did, whatever, seven or eight other times.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. And I think we got a neat little taste of what Tiger's like when he's feeling healthy and he's got proper spacing in between tournaments with the Zozo and then what happened at the President's Cup. I don't think anybody who witnessed the President's Cup came away thinking anything other than when Tiger feels good, he's still the best player in the world and it's not even close. But I also hear him speak and I hear you speak. And, you know, he's just going to have weeks where that back's just not going to feel good. And it wouldn't surprise me if tomorrow morning there was a marine layer that came in at Torrey Pines and there was a fog delay and maybe it was a little colder than usual and that back just didn't quite get as warmed up as he would have liked it to. And it's going to be a tough day because that's just the facts of his physical situation forever, for now on.
Yeah, and he said that. He said, there are some days it's just, I get up and I just, you know, it's not there. And he talked about, he said, you know, I can't, it takes me a long time to get ready to play. He said, I can't walk over. He said, I can't walk over to the first tee now and hit you a full driver. He said, I could probably, you know, bunch of something out there, 100 and something yards, but I can't make a full swing just right out of the box. I've got to get stressed. I got to do that. So, you know, when he's got a 6:40 pro-am time, he's up in the middle of the night just getting worked on so he can get out there and do it. But the other age, I mean, there are other players have their own challenges that they have to deal with. You know, obviously, Tigers are magnified. Every little thing he does. I mean, he looks good. He looks healthy. He seems to be in a good mood and excited to be back out. And, you know, now we'll just, you know, it starts here. We'll see him at L.A. And then pretty sure he's going to play Mexico City, the WGC. And then we'll see from there. I don't know. I expect he'll probably play match play. It'll be interesting to see how much he plays in Florida.
Yeah, that was going to be my question to you, the last Tiger question we were going to have, and that is, knowing what he has to go through on a daily basis to just get out to the golf course, that alone would be exhausting enough to where, I'm not going to be surprised if he really plays a very limited schedule, just because that's got to be a tedium that would grow very old very quick.
Yeah, I think he's really going to try to manage his schedule. Now, the sort of wild card in it is the whole Olympic pursuit and trying to get there and being in the top four Americans in the world ranking so he qualifies. It's something he really wants to do. But I think, you know, we're not going to see him play 3 weeks in a row. So I think when you see him play L.A. and then play Mexico City, which he likes, I think then you're going to see him take a break. You know, there's one school of thought that he doesn't play Bay Hill, that he plays plays players and then doesn't play again until the Masters. I mean, it kind of worked for him last year, as I recall. But so I think it's going to be hit and miss. You know, then again, you start looking more down the road, and, you know, those of us in Charlotte, we all wonder, any chance of Wells Fargo? And I think there's a fair chance of Wells Fargo this year because of the way it went last year, that once he played the Masters and didn't play again until the PGA, it wasn't there.
Yeah, and I agree.
So maybe he changes it up a little bit, but, you know, that's way on down the road right now.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. He's out at Torrey Pines. Earlier, you mentioned Fred Ridley in the Masters. I wanted to bring this up just because it's so funny to me. They purchased that land behind 13 from Augusta Country Club, and from the moment they purchased it, Fred Ridley said, look, we got to build a service road out there. Their Google Earth shots that were taken while the course was, you know, in its dormancy in the summertime, and lo and behold, it looks like a service road back there, but you have rampant speculation that we're building a tee box behind 13, and you bringing up the fact that Ridley's already said, I'm not doing anything till I see the distance report. Is it just because it's Augusta that we get people going crazy over things like this?
Oh, yeah, and because, you know, they keep things obviously very close to the vest, and I think you understand why they needed the service road. There's so much that goes on there, and that was a driving force behind what they did in buying that property. Now, do they have room to extend the 13th tee if they need to? Absolutely. Do I expect us to go down there this year?
No.
See it? No, no chance. Now, down the road, is it possible? It could be. I think it would be a shame if it had to happen because, I mean, that's arguably as good a hole as there is in the world. And the history and just, I mean, I just love to go down there and stand and look at it. And if they have to, you know, manufacture or recreate it a little bit just to, you want the guys, what was Ridley's line last year? It needs to be a momentous decision if you're going for that green. You don't, standing out there with a 7, 8, or 9 iron is not a momentous decision. They want guys hitting 4 irons, standing on that side hill line, looking at that creek and thinking, okay, is it worth it? And, if the weather cooperates, you can get some of that. Some of us have always wondered, couldn't you just put a well-placed tree down towards the corner that sort of forces the thing? But I think we'll just see where things go, as we always do with Augusta.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things we all enjoyed about seeing the Augusta Women's Amateur, because coming down the stretch, you had Fosse and Kupcho, and they were hitting hybrids and fairway metals and long irons for that second shot into 13, and it reminded us of what it was like when that used to be that way. And it was just, it's still one of the greatest par fives in the world.
Yeah, and I hope it can stay that way, but it is in some ways sort of Exhibit A in what we're talking about in terms of the distance thing.
Get you out of here on this. I wanted to talk with you about the evolution of some tournaments on tour. Looking at last week's American Express, what for years and years was the Bob Hope Desert Classic. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but my memory serves that it used to be a 90-hole event that started on Wednesday, and its pro-am portion of the competition in terms of star power was equal to that at Pebble Beach. Am I remembering that correctly?
You and I are remembering it the same way, but yeah, they sort of got out of the celebrity game part of it. A while back, they cut it to 72 holes. I think the players didn't love the whole notion of, one more extra round and all the pro-am part of it. So, I think they've got it in a pretty good place there. I think with Still's involvement there, I don't think he's involved in it like Tiger is at Genesis or, Jack or Arnie was at Bay Hill, but maybe it leads to that. I think he sees himself as the long-term ambassador there. It's a golf tournament that, if you catch it just right, you get that golf in a dome. It's beautiful. It's a great time of year to be out there. But, yeah, it does not, the Ray Romanos and the George Lopez's and the Huey Lewis's and all that, some Sea Pebble Beach, they're not out there anymore. It's more corporate dollars and business people.
Which leads me to the evolution or the ongoing evolution of what was once, I think, one of the greatest stops on the PGA Tour, and it's one that I know when Byron Nelson was alive that was near and dear to not just the tour, but all the players. They made a point of playing that tournament, and now you read where the Nelson that had moved away from Las Colinas out to that course that they wanted to be an inland links sort of looking thing that's been a disaster. Now they're leaving that course and could be moving back to Las Colinas. What do you get as the vibe on the future of that tournament, and it's one of the truly great Texas stops. Is it really in danger?
That's a good question. I, of all the tournaments on the tour, that's one I've never been to. I think it falls at an awkward time on the schedule, so it creates some challenges. I think they tried to do the right thing by moving it to Trinity Forest, a golf course that I think a lot of people like, but a lot of players didn't like. It didn't give it the jump start they wanted, and so now they're rethinking it. I think that little two-step they have there with there in Colonial, Colonial has all the historical relevance and all that, and it's a golf course that fits a certain type of player really well. I think the Nelson is one of those tournaments that is really struggling to find its place and its identity, and you give them credit for trying some different things, but I don't know if they have the answer just yet.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr., and when we return, the former American caddy at St. Andrews, Oliver Horvitz, joins us to take dead aim at a crazy tournament he took part in, literally at the top of the world, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Oliver Horvitz is best described by me as a golf adventurer. Once upon a time, he went to school on a lark at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Yeah, that St. Andrews. He wound up ditching the whole student thing and became, for many years, the American caddy at St. Andrews, the home of golf. His book about that adventure is fantastic. Anyway, he's gone on to host online golf travel adventure shows and recently wrote a piece for golfdigest.com about a golf tournament he took part in, literally at the top of the world. So, Ollie, every time I talk with you, I'm scratching my head at, number one, what people will pay you to do. But this is insanity. This is true insanity because rarely have you done something to chase golf, if ever done something to chase golf, that put your life in jeopardy. And we will get into this in stunning detail. Needless to say, you headed to Nepal again. Now, before we get to this reason for Nepal, I want to give everybody a little quick background. You and I reconnected a couple of years ago off a story that you had done about a female golfer in Nepal. I believe her name was Pratima?
Yeah, Pratima Sherpa. Yep.
Okay. Catch me up on who she is and what she's doing now and how all that came about.
Sure. Yeah, the quick backstory on Pratima. Met her in 2016. I was in Nepal with two buddies to do an article about the golf in Nepal, six golf courses. And we're at Royal Nepal Golf Course, the oldest of the courses, and I meet Pratima. Now, at the time, she's 16, number one female golfer in Nepal, lives in a shed on the fourth hole of Royal Nepal Golf Club.
And we're not being facetious when we say shed.
Correct. Literally a shed that has golf cutters, you know, mowers, equipment. And then 20% of the shed is for her and her parents. They share one room. And so we meet Pratima. She's wearing a nice golf shirt. It turns out that's the nicer of the two golf shirts she owned. So we just all looked at each other and said, we have to do something. She could be the first ever female golf pro in the history of the country. So I wrote a Golf Digest piece about her. We did a big fundraiser for her on GoFundMe. And the really cool jump ahead is she now is in America in college at Santa Barbara City College as a freshman playing on the golf team and well on her way to achieving her dream of becoming the first ever female golf pro in the history of Nepal.
That was fantastic. I think the last time we discussed Pratima, she had done for lack of a better term, an exchange student situation.
Correct.
Where she lived with a family in California for an extended period of time, but then she had to go back to Nepal, and that's where I guess the I had lost track of the story. So
that's
made
right.
it.
And she still stays with this wonderful family, the Montagna, on weekends in near Santa Barbara, and then she stays with another wonderful host family in Santa Barbara during the week. These are just two of, we're talking, you know, just the kindest, most generous families you can meet who are hosting her, and she's taking classes, playing on the golf team, just came second in the entire state of California's community college championship, and she's played in two Symetra Tour events last year as well. Isn't that cool?
This is fantastic. Golf adventurer Oliver Horovitz is our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, so that gives you background on why you initially went to Nepal. So when you get your cell phone rings in Washington Square, New York City, and it's your man Deepak, and let's just discuss this. Deepak must be like the name Mike and John over there. It seems like every time there's a story about Nepal or India, there's a Deepak involved.
Yeah, we got a few Deepaks.
A few Deepaks involved over there.
Over there, but yeah, we got a few Deepaks.
Okay, so who is this Deepak, and what did he have to say?
He's the best. He's he's probably one of the best golfers in the country. He's one of the first golf pros over there. He's the head pro at the best golf course, Gokarna Forest Resort. Super cool guy. I mean, I think he had course records at almost every course there. We're talking like 6-8 under. This guy can play. So I got real tight with him when we were over there in 16, and we stayed in touch. And then I got a phone call. I'm just thinking he's going to say, hey, you know, whatever. What are your holiday plans, et cetera? And instead he goes, hey, I got kind of some important news to give you. And I go, okay, what's up, Deepak? And he says, we're holding the world's highest golf tournament in like 2 weeks on Everest. Do you want to come? Yeah, I wasn't expecting that, any of that.
And the second I hear on Everest, those two words, the next words that pop into my head are Into Thin Air and John Krakauer, and there's no way in hell I'm getting anywhere near Mount Everest. But that's just me, Ollie. You say, sure, I'm all in.
Of course I said yes. And then, you know, that night, 2 a.m, like total panic attack, being like, what have I just signed up for? Is this safe? What's happening? We're going up in helicopters is the plan. Everyone's going up in helicopters, either directly from Kathmandu, which is at about 4,000 feet, to 14,000 feet over the course of a 45-minute helicopter ride. If you're not doing that, you're taking a plane to 9,000 feet at Lukla, which is the starting point for everyone going up to Everest, like climbing-wise, and then you take a 5-minute chopper ride to 14,000 feet the next morning. In both instances, you're basically not doing what you're supposed to do, which is acclimatize.
Oh, no, and I've got a dumb question. I've been up in helicopters before and done helicopter tours before.
Yeah.
But those are at, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 feet. Is there a special helicopter that goes to 14,000 feet?
There has been a helicopter that has now landed on the top of Everest. There was literally a rescue almost from the very top. So they are able... Most B-3 choppers are able to get up into the 20,000, 23,000 range. I've now talked to a lot of the helicopter pilots who do rescues on Everest, and Camp 2, Camp 3 is, like, totally in play. But the air is so thin that you have to be really careful up there. So is it safe? You know.
Golf adventurer and certified nut, Oliver Horvitz. Is our guest taking that in? We're talking about an article he's written on golfdigest.com about a golf tournament at basically the top of the world at Mount Everest. So once your sanity comes back and you realize you've agreed to do this and something tells you, you know, I might want to check in to this whole breathing thing before I head over there. Who did you contact? Because his story is interesting.
So first I asked every Nepali friend that I have, both in Nepal and in New York, if they would do this. And all of them were like, look, not, you know, they're like, it's not like walking to the grocery store, but it's going to be the most beautiful flight you've ever been on. You should do it. But then I'm like, all right, what am I actually going to do in up in this altitude? How am I going to respond? Is this really a good idea? So I stumbled upon this guy who basically is the Jack Nicklaus of high altitude medicine, right? Dr. Peter Hackett. He's got this very cool Institute for Altitude Medicine in Telluride, Colorado. I'm like, oh, this would be so cool if I could just ask him some questions. And there's a, you know, there's like a phone number. They're like, he is out of the country. Leave a message. Maybe he'll get back to you. So I leave this really stupid, rambling message. I do not get my point across well. I do leave my number. I'm like, this guy's never going to call me back. This ain't going to happen. And then he does a week later. And not only that, but gives me like almost an hour of his time on the phone.
So what sort of preparation before you even go over there do you do? And then once you're there, what's your preparation to actually get your body ready to get in that helicopter and go up 14,000 feet?
Yeah, the problem is there's not a lot of preparation you can do. Like your body, my body, it's sort of set how it's going to respond at altitude. It's built into our genetic code.
And each person's different. This is like motion sickness or anything else.
Yes, exactly. Some people are the fittest people you ever know. They could be Army Rangers, but they just cannot perform at altitude. And they'll start getting those effects of high altitude sickness, you know, even at 12,000 feet or 30, you just don't know until you try it. So I had all these, you know, these kind of safety blanket ideas like, oh, I'll drink lots of water. You're supposed to hydrate. I'll take Diamox, which is the, you know, it's a diuretic initially, but it's supposed to make you better at altitude. And then Peter Hackett was like, that's not really, neither is going to help you. You're just going up too fast. And I was like, okay, that's not comforting me. And basically, in about half an hour, he gave me this amazing lecture on everything I didn't know about high altitude effects in medicine.
So when you got off the phone with the Jack Nicklaus of altitude medicine, did you feel better or worse about the decision you'd made?
Worse. And then it was followed up 10 minutes later by an email from Golf Digest being like, yes, we definitely want this article. Go. This is fantastic. I was like, I guess I'm hooked into this now. And what really I think what really sealed the deal was just getting to go back to Nepal, because, you know, that was my third time back there for this golf tournament. And I have so many friends there now. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it.
You describe your man Deepak as the pro at the nicest course in Nepal. I remember seeing the course that Pratima's father worked at and that where she lived. And, you know, it wasn't by their standards a bad course, but to us it looked like a pretty rough Muni. When you say the nicest course in Nepal, give me sort of a frame of reference.
Right. Well, this one actually is international standard.
Oh, okay.
Gokana Forest was designed by David McClay Kidd.
Oh, okay. Bandit.
So it's actually really, really nice. And Royal Nepal, where Pratima lives and where she grew up playing, is an awesome course. It's just, you know, they have a couple grass cutters. It's not the same level of money pumped into it as you know, Monterey Peninsula. But the course itself is super fascinating. There's monkeys all over the course. Two of the holes are on holy land. Of the largest Hindu temple in Nepal, so it's a hell of an experience playing it, and there's some good golfers there. 700 golfers in the whole country, by the way, for Nepal. Only 700.
That is golf adventurer and certified lunatic Oliver Horovitz, and up next, he continues to take dead aim at this unbelievably crazy golf tournament played at the top of the world, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We are taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors, and continue now with Oliver Horovitz and a tournament contested literally at the top of the world in Nepal. So you get over to Nepal.
Yeah.
What is the time between when you're getting to Nepal and when this tournament starts? And I'm assuming, as I'm reading this article and not knowing how it's going to end up, in my mind, I'm like, God almighty, who built a course at 14,000 feet? And then I realized, no, dummy, it can't possibly be like that. So, first off, the length of time from when you get to Nepal to when the tournament starts, and then what exactly is this tournament?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot. I landed, and then we left the next day. So I had, like, less than 24 hours to even just get my bearings after, like, 31 hours of traveling. You're right. You're not right, and you're right about the course. They didn't build a whole course up there, but they built a hole. So the first hole of the tournament is at 14,000 feet, and the other 17 holes are actually at that golf course we just talked about, Gokarna Forest.
Ah.
You play one hole, and then you play the other 17 to finish the tournament. So we're all going up. The whole thing is happening. This military type operation with over 100 people going up is for one hole, and we're back by like 10:30 in the morning the same day. That's the plan.
How many people participating in this tournament? In other words, how many certified insane people did Deepak find to say yes?
A lot of people. Everyone said yes, and they had to turn away people. And I think with all the ground support, with all the crew up there, the photographers, it was going to be 100 people in total who are getting ferried up to 14,000 feet.
How many copters? How many? I mean, this had to look like some kind of bizarre motorcade in the sky.
Yeah, there was an Mi-17 Nepali Army helicopter from Kathmandu going directly. That's kind of like the big, big, good, safe one you want. And then a couple B-3 choppers, which are themselves used for rescue, used for ferrying supplies all over the Himalayas and the Khumbu Valley. Those were going to meet us in Lukla and go up. So I decided, you know what? I just want to get to 9,000 feet first and do a little acclimatizing. It's clearly, according to this expert, Peter Hackett, it's not enough, but I want to do a little bit. So I flew the next morning into Lukla, 9,000 feet. It's the gateway to Everest. Everyone on my flight were golfers. So there were dudes with Titleist hats, Callaway vests. Some guy had two golf gloves on the plane. He was extra excited.
Oh, my gosh. You had Tommy
cool.
Gainey on your flight.
Exactly.
Jeez.
Exactly. And by the way, it's not like I'm copping out and taking the easy way in, because I don't want to make too big of a deal, but it is actually, you're flying to the world's most dangerous airport, Lukla's Edmund Hillary Airport is the most dangerous in the world. It's one runway. It's about half the size of a normal runway. It's banked at 11%, which means it's insanely uphill. And you have one shot to get it right because in front of the runway is the cliff of the hillside.
So who's crazier, people who are paying to fly into this place or people who are actually flying the plane into
this
place?
That's right. You just sort of, you get on the plane and you say a very common refrain in Nepali, which is the equivalent of Hakuna Matata. It's Ke Garne. And Ke Garne is literally translated as, what is there to do? You just say to yourself, Ke Garne.
Oh, my gosh. Oliver Horovitz, our guest, Taking Dead Aim. He's written a great article in Golf Digest, golfdigest.com, about a golf tournament at the top of the world. So you go to 9,000 feet. How long do you hang out there?
So there, we're there for a day, and we had a chipping tournament in our hotel, in the grounds. Everyone's sort of like out of breath doing a hike to get prepped for it. We're there for one day. Or not even. The next morning is our go day to get up there, starting early for the helicopters.
You arrive. You see this magnificent hole created at 14,000 feet. What are the dimensions of the hole? How big a shot are we talking about?
Yep.
What is your carry? What are your hazards?
100-yard par 3, downhill, very small green. Pin is 3 paces from the back edge. Every piece of supplies and equipment to build this hole had been brought up by helicopter from Kathmandu, including the flagstick, artificial green, artificial tee. It had been constructed over about a week. Deepak, the head pro at Gokarna, he supervised it. And they even had 4 photographers who didn't fly up there. They hiked up over, I think, 5 days or something like that, all the way up to be totally acclimatized so they wouldn't be out of breath and they could shoot nicely on the day. So they put a lot of work into this golf hole. But, yeah, it's at 14,000 feet. Conde Ree, it's as the best view of Everest in the whole region. Conde is not a place you want to get stuck because there is literally nothing else around it. You're just in Conde in the wild.
Ollie, how does equipment respond at that altitude? And speaking of like your iPhone or whatever kind of smartphone you use or whatever kind of camera you're using, is there danger of it freezing up? Or?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When you go up there, if you're staying overnight in anything up there, you're going to want to put all your stuff in your sleeping bag. And actually, when I was in Nepal in 16, we went up to Everest Base Camp. I forgot to mention that. And I took a golf club, I dug a driver up, and I hit a ball off Everest Base Camp at 17,000 feet. I'd like to say the ball went really far, but I could barely tee it up. I was so tired. And it went very low into a glacier, or into a crevasse, rather, about 100 feet off where I hit it.
It sounds like a really bad Bill Murray speech from
exactly.
Caddyshack.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, so that was my next question. What clubs did you take with you? Just a wedge or something?
They had clubs up there for us, and some guys, of course, brought their entire setup. So there were dudes on the flight with golf clubs with a whole bag of stuff. But this all did not go to plan.
Everything
I told you was all the planning. We wake up the next morning, and I look up at where we're going to go, which is the top of a mountain, and you cannot see anything. It's just clouds. Not good.
Yeah, they can't fly into
that. Not good, because the number one rule of flying helicopters in the Khumbu Valley on Everest is do not fly into clouds. If you do that, you will lose your helicopter license. You have a very good chance of crashing the helicopter. You absolutely cannot do this. So I'm looking. I can't even see the mountain. I just see clouds. And I look at one of the event organizers, Surya, and I'm like, what's happening now? And he's like, we wait. It's like, okay. We go to the helicopter pad. We just wait. We wait. We wait. We go, oh, there's no way we're doing this. There's a little break in the clouds. There's not enough. I'm just like, what is happening? All of a sudden, they're like, first chopper, first chopper. We're like, what? They send a helicopter up. There was a break in the clouds. The pilot could get through, find a window in the clouds. And 4 people went up, and they made it to Conde, and they played the hole. So at least 4 got up. So then it became official. It was the world's highest golf tournament. The chopper, however, has to – the next one going up can't do it, and it gets diverted to a different – basically a different peak, and then it just gets very chaotic. There's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of confusion. And then I realize a rainstorm is coming towards Lukla. So none of this is good at the moment.
At some point –
does a little voice in the back of your head say, Ollie, this may be a sign that I don't need to proceed any further here?
Oh, it was more than a little voice. It was a loud screaming voice throughout my entire body. It's like, what am I doing? And they come to me and they say, Oliver, we found one pilot who is going to try to get you to Condé. He's agreed. It's very dangerous, but he will try to do it. The thing is, you might get stuck there overnight. And if you do, then you're at 14,000 feet overnight. And I was like, oh, my God, that really doesn't seem good. And then, I don't know, fortunately, unfortunately, it got even crazier with the clouds, and they had to scrap the whole thing. So we ran to the airport, jumped on a plane, went back. 10 minutes later after we left the airport shuts down, and everybody else is stuck there at least overnight, if not longer.
Oh, wow. So were the organizers just crestfallen?
They were disappointed, but you know what? When you're flying helicopters in the Khumbu Valley in Nepal, weather just changes so quickly, and it's a fact of life. And I think they handled it really well because they didn't try to do anything really stupid. They knew when it was not safe to fly anymore. The really amazing thing is that 2 days later, something like 10 more golfers got up there, and they were able to play the hole. And they landed in snow. It was snowing up there when they did it. Yeah, my friend Mahendra lost his ball in a snowfield. So I had to DQ. I had to unfortunately DQ, but it was still a very good story. And to be there as all this stuff was happening, it was Nepali through and through in the best way possible. And if there was any indication that Nepalis love their golf, this was it.
So what's the future? Are they going to try to do this again?
They are. They're going to do, apparently, they are going to put one on next year or this year later on that might even be even bigger. And I haven't heard the full details yet, but I can assure you if it happens, I'm going to try to go back over and do it again. I need some revenge on this tournament.
Wow. Unbelievable. Now, you talk about some of the guys who had all their sticks with them, and they were up at least that 9,000 level with you. Have you seen someone peg it in the ground and have enough stamina and enough wherewithal about them to just unload and to see how far a ball actually goes?
It goes far because, you know, even at 6,000 feet, you get an extra, what, 10%?
All right, yeah.
So you can go real far at 14,000 feet, and they were apparently driving it really, really far. Of course, you're dressed like the Michelin Man because you have so much stuff on because it's so freezing cold up there. But they were crushing it up there. What I loved was my friend Mahendra, who's one of the top lawyers in Nepal, came with us for the tournament, and he was really stressed because he had to get back to go to Nepali Supreme Court 2 hours later to argue a case. That is dedication to your golf obsession.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was looking at his watch a lot throughout that morning.
All right, so you get done, you DQ, you didn't get to do what you wanted to do. Were there any lingering effects on you personally from that altitude? And if so, how long did it take for them to dissipate?
No, I felt good. I was just, we get back to Kathmandu, I go back to Rural Nepal, we're having breakfast back in Rural Nepal Golf Club. I'm feeling good. I'm just, everyone's coming up to me being like, hey, how'd the tournament go? And I had to tell them I didn't get up there. And it was crushing. It was crushing. And I have a lot of friends of the golf club because we did that, the piece on Pratima, and a lot of people are following Pratima there and they're pumped. So a lot of people were commiserating with me. And then the whole reason I had to leave the next morning to fly back out of Kathmandu was I had to go back to New York and turn around the day after to go to Bolivia for a magazine piece about a golf course there. So I go all the way back to New York after this. I land at JFK Airport, turn on my phone. The first thing that comes in is there's rioting and protests in Bolivia, and my host texts me and goes, you have to cancel your trip right now to Bolivia.
Look, this is amazing. The places that you go, okay? You go to Everest where nothing but bad things have happened. Look, how did it work out for Butch and Sundance in Bolivia?
Right.
Not well.
Right, exactly.
Not well. You need to go someplace. You know what? You need to go someplace like Oregon.
That'd be nice.
There's like no problems in Oregon. The article is called A Wild Trip to the World's Highest Golf Tournament, Golf Adventure and Certified Nut, Oliver Horovitz. It's at golfdigest.com. As always, thanks for your sharing your wild life with me.
Thanks so much. It's the nicest country in the world, nicest people in the world, awesome golfers. If anyone wants to visit Nepal, you absolutely should. It's incredible.
Once the American caddy at St. Andrews, golf adventurer, and in my opinion now certified lunatic. That's Oliver Horovitz. I also would like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for his time and insight this week. Hey, reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studio, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now. Links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Weather-wise, well, I think for the first time in a while, we got nothing but sunny skies. A little on the chilly side, but not too chilly. But sunny skies here in the Carolinas. And that means plenty of opportunity for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.